So was your personal financial information stolen in the Equifax data breach? Were you one of the approximately 143 million Americans affected by this? Well, Equifax told me when I checked online that my information was probably not impacted. Probably not. For some reason, that doesn't really put my mind at ease. So what should we do to protect ourselves? We'll find out during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will have some information and advice on the Equifax breach, long-term care insurance, what to buy to prepare for a disaster, and he'll have answers to your personal finance questions, too, at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So, Kevin, my mind is not at ease with this. You are probably not impacted. So what do we need to know, and what should we do, Kevin?
It is such a mess. As you probably heard, Equifax, one of the three largest credit reporting bureaus, these are entities which store your personal and financial information so that lenders can check and see if they should indeed lend you money. It's not just used by lenders. Your credit report is also used by auto insurers, homeowners insurance, cell phone carriers. You might get it checked if you're a renter and the landlord is trying to decide if he or she is going to rent an apartment to you. They just revealed that 143 million people, that's 55% of the adult population in America, had some combination of their names, their addresses, their social security numbers, their birth date, their driver's license, about 209,000 people's credit card numbers were in a database that was stolen. And already certain parties have claimed that they have it, and they're holding it ransom for $2.6 million in Bitcoin, the cryptocurrency, but there's no idea whether those people even have it, nor if they've already gone out there and sold it. So it may already be too late, and your information is probably exposed. And even if you go to the site, as you mentioned, which we'll talk about, you just kind of need to assume that that your information is going to be out there.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about Equifax's announcement and response to this.
Yeah, it was terrible. They allegedly found out about the hack, which happened in May and June mostly. They found out about it on July 29th and then waited 5 weeks to tell us about it. In the meantime, several Equifax executives sold their stock, claiming they weren't aware of the hack. Obviously, when the news came out, it hurt the price of the stock dramatically. The people in charge of reporting the hack to the board said, no, we told them that that this thing had happened. They put up a website so that you can check it, as you mentioned. And, of course, it's a horrible domain name. It's EquifaxSecurity2017.com. Equifax is E-Q-U-I-F-A-X. EquifaxSecurity2017.com. We'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com. They allow you, as you mentioned, Joy, to see if your information was part of the hack and part of the data breach. And they also allow you to sign up for 1 year of free credit monitoring services from Equifax. And, of course, after that year, then they'll start billing you $19.95 per month for this alleged service. And there was even this they screwed up, because there was a part in the terms of service where they said, yes, because you were exposed, we'll give you a free year of credit monitoring. In the mouse print of the boilerplate agreement, there was something in there that says, if you click this, it means that you can't use arbitration, or you can't sue us for any problems arising to this. And of course, people said, well, of course we're going to sue you for this, because it could have tremendous damage. There's already been, as far as I know, 5 lawsuits filed against Equifax just in the last week since the news came out. And Equifax quickly came out and said, no, this just relates to the actual use of the service, not the breach. And then even when you sign up for this dumb thing, they don't allow you to say, okay, good, you're in. They say, all right, your data sign up is September 17th. write it down, because that's the last you're going to hear from us. If you don't sign up after September 17th, then you're not signed up for it at all. And I'm guessing in part because they would have literally tens of millions of people signing up for this thing immediately, and they didn't have the server capacity to handle it.
Oh, I was going to say, what in the world was that? Yeah, I thought, so a week from now, you say I can enroll in this, I better remember to do it or I'm out of luck. It's like, normally you would think that that we would be contacted we would be notified that we had our data stolen, and we would be automatically enrolled without having to go through this rigmarole.
Right, and I'm sure they're scrambling. I mean, to be fair, it really was the company's fault and their systems and procedures. It wasn't the individuals in charge for it, and they only have so much capacity to handle something, which is really, I mean, this is the equivalent, not in terms of calamity, but in terms of a crisis for a company. It's like, you know, a Three Mile Island nuclear accident.
Yeah. So what should we do to protect ourselves?
Well, a couple things that you can think about, and a lot of this is on Equifax's website, but you might want to freeze your credit report. When you freeze your credit report, it costs about $10 per bureau, depending on the situation and whether or not you've been a victim of identity theft. But it prevents institutions from looking into your credit bureau file, and that prevents them from offering you a credit card account, let's say, or a loan. If you do actually are applying for a loan or you're trying to get a credit card legitimately, you can thaw it or unfreeze it or open up the file or whatever. And then after the entity, the bank, let's say, or credit union looks at it, gets your approval, hopefully, then you can close it back up again. If you have current relationships with the lender, like your current credit card company or your mortgage lender, they can still see the information for it. But no one can open up a credit card or a loan in your name without you unfreezing this. So I'd highly recommend that you freeze your credit report. If you want information on it, there's a Consumer Reports put together a database of the state by state of how people should go about this. You can go to tinyurl.com/freezecred. tinyurl.com/freezecred. And again, we'll have that link at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, so then if we do that, can we breathe easy then?
Of course not. Even if you don't do that, you may want to have a fraud alert put on all of your different accounts. And this is something that alerts, say, your credit card company that, excuse me, I've been the victim of potential identity theft. If you see any odd activity, like charges coming from entities that I don't normally use or places geographically that I'm not usually charging accounts in, please let me know, and please don't put the charge through. You also want to check your credit reports, and this is the raw data that is basically stored by these credit bureaus. But you can check yours one per bureau per year for free at annualcreditreport.com. annualcreditreport.com, one per bureau per year free, and just go through that and see, and just make sure all of the information that they have shows that actual accounts that you've opened, balances, etc., so you can see if any other accounts have been opened in your name in the meantime. You need to monitor your credit card statements and your debit card statements. This is something that's very important, because if someone is trying to draw money from your checking account, you only have a few days before you become liable for any mistakes or money that's been pulled out without your permission for it. This is going to have an issue with medical services as well. Someone can claim to be you and go get medical treatment, and then they send a bill to you, and of course you say, I never got that. We're going to hear more about this after the first of the year, because one of the problems we've talked about with people filing income taxes using other people's social security numbers and claiming to get a big refund, and then people come back in and actually file their own taxes and find out that the IRS says, nope, sorry, you already sent your taxes in and we sent you a big refund. So that's going to be an issue. Now, a lot of people are going to ask about these credit monitoring services like the one Equifax provided. Please don't buy the one that Equifax provides just out of punishment for them. but LifeLock and some of these other places offer this service. service for $10 to $20 a month. It's like most insurance. If it makes you feel better to have it, please go ahead and get it. But many of these services only let you know after the fact, after there's been some kind of breach or some kind of account opened up. And so it depends on if you want to do it or if you want to have the service try to monitor it for you. The cost is usually $10 to $20 a month. Others, like the Wallet Hub, the website, they actually have a free credit monitoring service if you sign up for an account with them. But you have to give them permission to look into your data. And then, of course, that can bring a whole host of other issues, like, you know, are they going to use it to market certain services to you? So it's up to you which poison you want to pick.
Kevin, I just want to clarify, should we or shouldn't we actually enroll in the free credit monitoring for a year that Equifax is offering?
Based on the current information we have, I would say yes. Go ahead and enroll into it. Just make sure if my number hasn't come up yet, so they haven't said, okay, now you're ready to go ahead and sign up for it. So when it does, I'll report back on what we find out. But if they do ask you to put any credit card information in there for some reason, just make sure that within a year you cancel it so that you aren't billed for it unless you actually want it.
Right. So are there... what are the long-term ramifications of this breach?
As we mentioned at the top of the story, you can probably assume that even if you were fortunate enough to not be included in this and say you may not have an issue with it, your information is probably out there. It's probably been sold already. I really hope, I'll be shocked if it happens, but I really hope that there's some government enforcement action taken against not just Equifax, obviously, but all these companies that have our information. And when they goof up and they make mistakes, like every company does, this will happen again in the future. But it doesn't seem fair that this is something that the rest of us never really asked for. We didn't say, oh, hey, Equifax, will you please store our data for us and then report back to the banks for it? But because they've made a mistake and they've made an error, we have to pay for it. We are inconvenienced for it, and we're stressed out about it, and that's not fair. It should be a case of where if it's something where we made an arrangement with the entity and we are okay with them having our information, we've accepted the risk for it, but we never signed on to all this. They just gathered the data, and obviously they didn't do a very good job of taking care of it, nor did they do a very good job of letting us know when there was a problem with it in a timely manner.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin or a money dilemma, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Mary in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I and another person in my family had our three accounts frozen in 2015. So when I went on to the Equifax site, I felt confident that I was going to hear that, you know, we were safe. I was shocked to read that based on the information provided, we believe your personal information may have been impacted by this incident. Oh, I was just shocked. So I'd just like to ask your opinion on our situation and maybe what we should do about it. I did send a letter immediately to Equifax stating my outrage.
Yeah. And freezing your account doesn't mean that a hacker can't get at it, right, Kevin?
Oh, apparently this is the Joy Cardine show again. Oh,
yes.
No, you're exactly right, Joy. It's two different situations going on here, Mary. One is that you did freeze your account, which technically meant that other entities couldn't go in and request your information in the process of trying to approve whether or not they should borrow or they should lend money to you. But that has nothing to do with this. That just means that it's kind of like saying that you were holding money in your safe for some other people, and somebody else came into your house and stole the safe. And so it's not surprising that you'd still may have an issue for it. And several people have gone into the database and typed in random numbers and social security numbers, et cetera, for the Equifax test to see if you've been affected, and it still shows up that you may have been affected. So just because it says you have doesn't mean you have. Just because it says you aren't doesn't mean you aren't. I would go through those steps that I mentioned about freezing your credit report still. Just because the information's out there doesn't necessarily mean there is going to be damages to you, but you have to do everything you possibly can to not only protect against those damages by freezing your credit report, but also about really monitoring your all of your credit card accounts and the credit scores and your debit card accounts as well.
I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money, and we will take more of your personal finance questions for Kevin in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
It's the root of all evil, a strife and upheaval, but I'm certain, honey, that life would be sunny.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you'd like to run a money question by Kevin. Here's a question from a listener who says, "Hi, Kev, love the show."
So informal.
Kev, I'm going to call you
Good
Kev.
False no. appreciation. I like Kev. Hey, Kev.
What financial options are available through financial institutions for starting a small business? Generally speaking, what are the terms as far as interest, length of loan, and down payment? We would need somewhere between $130,000 and $170,000. Our credit score is approximately 800. So, Kev, what do you think?
Well, first, let's go with the good news. Their credit score is very good.
Yeah, it is good. Uh-oh. Kevin, are you there?
I'm there.
Okay, what happened?
But that's the only the good news about this about this question.
All right. So he has a good credit score, but what else is what is not so good then?
Well, without knowing more, that's really the only good thing about the situation. It is extremely difficult to borrow money in a traditional manner to start a business. It likely has to be securitized by a building, meaning you're, let's say if you're opening a store, you're buying the building. They're not just going to give you money with no backing that they can't eventually sell if and when you run into trouble. And even then, if you are buying real estate, you need a down payment for that. So if you need to borrow $250,000, let's say, to purchase a building to run a restaurant or a store, you probably need to come up with at least $50,000 to $75,000 of your own money just for the down payment on that building. And you're going to have lots of cash flow issues starting the business up where you're going to be spending more money than you're going to be making. So it's probably a case where if you need to borrow $130,000 to $170,000, you probably don't have the money for the down payment, much less to fund the extra expenses going forward for it. So if there's no real estate in it, generally, if you don't have an established business, you're not going to get a loan. Yeah.
What other options are available for entrepreneurs?
They'll probably want to know what your personal financial situation is, and that's why having the high credit score is so good. But this might mean taking out a home equity loan, a home equity line of credit, or even getting a new mortgage for as much as the lender will allow. And, of course, that's an easier way to get financing with such a good credit score. But it also means you are now subjecting your home equity and your home to the risks of the business. You might want to think about tapping your savings and retirement accounts to do so. And, again, you are jeopardizing your savings and your retirement accounts. You can talk with friends and family and see if they'll get them to believe in you and lend you some money or maybe buy some invest in your business as well. And then you can look at some of the online resources like Prosper or Lending Club. Or if you really got a unique business idea that a lot of people would be interested in, a product that they'd get excited about, you might want to look at crowdfunding it by going to Kickstarter, telling them about your product, what you're coming out with, and see if they're willing to give you money upfront for it so that you can develop the product and then deliver to them at some point in the future. But most small business people, Joy, especially those who are starting slowly, they start by credit cards. They have a good credit rating, they get as many credit cards as they have, and they pay anywhere from 12 to 28% interest on this while they're trying to get things going.
So where should our emailer start in his quest for funding?
I would actually go to your local business lender. This might be at a bank or a credit union, and just sit down with him or her and say, here's our situation. Here's what we're trying to do. Can you look at our situation and tell us if there are any resources we can use, either that the lender can offer, or are there some Small Business Administration loans that that we might qualify for? If you want to see if that's the case, go to SBA.gov, SBA.gov, and they'll be able to tell you, you know, there are some small loans that you can use to get started. This is a pretty significant amount. Unless you have something, again, that can be securitized, you might have to go through what they call alternative financing.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. If you have a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, Tom in Burlington is with us. Hi, Tom.
I received a call yesterday, and the ID number was no name, so I didn't know who it was from. But it was from 414, which was around Milwaukee. And the woman asked me, she asked me what my name was, first of all. And then she asked me what my birthday was. And then I said, well, you're getting too personal, and I didn't answer her. But my question is there a way that they identify themselves as America Credit? She sounded like an American with a nice voice. But I wonder, is there a place in, do these people have to register in Wisconsin to be a bill collector? And is there a way in Wisconsin I can call some bureau or something and say, are these people reputable or something?
And I'm sorry, so they wanted to know your date of birth, Tom?
They wanted to know my date of birth. Yeah. And first of all, she wanted to know my name. And then, well, she wanted to know my number. It was my cell phone number. And then she wanted to know my date of birth. And I said, well, that's about it. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I wouldn't have given any of that.
Don't give any of that information out to anybody over the phone. Here's a good, I'm glad you brought this up, Tom. No one who matters will call you asking for any of that kind of information. The IRS won't call you. Microsoft won't call you. Chase Manhattan Bank won't call you. The ones who actually need it, they already have it. And the ones who really need any kind of information from you, it's much easier and it's easier to document it if they send it to you through the mail. And, of course, it's much harder for scammers to make money going through the mail. It's easier for them to scale their scam if they just call people up randomly and try to convince them to do what this woman was trying to convince you to do. And I don't know where you can check for it. Do you owe some money to somebody, Tom, that would have been sold to a bill collector?
No. And I thought I don't have anything outstanding.
Good.
But the thing is, how can I check on her? Like, is there somebody in how can I?
I'm gonna suggest, Tom, that you go to the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and the Consumer Protection people, if they don't deal directly with this type of telephone call, would know who you should go to.
I'm so glad, Joy, that you actually are retiring, because it sounds like you could take over for me now. So I'm feeling a little threatened by this.
Sorry.
No, that's a good idea. You can contact the Better Business Bureau. And just because a phone number comes up on your caller ID saying it's 414 or 920 or whatever, that doesn't at all mean that those people are actually located in that area code. It's easy to spoof telephone numbers on caller ID, so someone can be calling you from Eastern Europe or Jamaica or wherever, and still you might see a 414 area code. Just because it looks local doesn't actually mean that the call is coming from in the house, as they say.
Yeah. Good luck, Tom. Chris in Madison is with us. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I guess it's a good problem to have. And I talked to you last month about this. My wife and I sold our house. We are living in a place rent-free, so we don't have to worry about paying rent. We have no outstanding debts. But just really, we're sitting here with about $120,000 in cash, trying to decide on what a good, safe place to put it is, and in a good place to invest it. Have two children that are going to be entering college in a couple of years, and so we're just sort of trying to figure out, though, what to do with the cash proceeds from a home sale.
Well, Chris, first of all, good news. The Wisconsin membership drive is coming. Wisconsin Public Radio membership drive is coming up in a couple weeks, and I think I know your limits of how much you can give during the membership drive. So, are you going to need the money, Chris? Are you planning on buying a house or anything like that? Or are you going to rent for the foreseeable future?
No, we actually are in a position where we don't even have to rent. My wife's job is actually providing us housing, and that's why we don't need to rent. And we're going to be there at least 4, 5, 6 years, I would guess. And that's just, I'm thinking she may stay longer, but that we know we're good at least for that long.
Okay. Are you both maximizing out your retirement savings options, like at work or with IRAs and Roth IRAs?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah, it's like you mentioned, Chris, it's a good problem to have. Do the kids, are they on a track where you would say they're going to go to a reasonable, affordable school, or are they going to try to blow you out of the water with some private school, out-of-state university that you aren't going to get much financial aid for?
Well, I think we're okay with the financial aid, mostly because we've already been putting money into 529s for them.
Okay.
We could probably add more if we wanted, but we've got a consistent 529 savings plan going for them. The younger one, I expect both of them to qualify for. One's going to probably potentially get an athletic scholarship, and I'm not being pie in the sky there with that. And then the other one is probably going to get a decent academic scholarship. So,
okay.
I mean, we know we can spend money on them for that, but we're trying to figure out a good, safe place. I know the miracle would be a safe place with great returns.
Yeah, you're lucky if you can get one of those. You may not get either one of those. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is at or near an all-time high, as are many other stock measurements. Interest rates are up a little bit in the last 6 months, but still very low. And so if you want both of those things, the best thing to do might be able to split it and say, well, we're going to take half of this and put it in a longer-term CD that we might be able to get 2% or more on, and then we're going to take the other half and put it in something that's more aggressive, that has more potential for return, but also more potential chance for loss. And the reason that I want you to have the CD in there is not just because for safety reasons. It's also, you never know with these situations if your wife is going to actually have this free housing. And I wouldn't want you to have money exposed to the stock market and potential loss. And then for some reason, either she decides she doesn't want to work where she's working, or they decide that they don't want to have her there. And then all of a sudden, not only is she out of a job, but you're looking for a house. And I want you to have some money to live off of and potentially use for a down payment for a house. So if you do invest it more aggressively, don't put any more than, I'd say, half of that into that kind of investment, and keep the rest just set aside safe. Again, you're not going to make much on it, but you're not going to lose it, and it will be there if you do need it.
Good luck to you, Chris. Thanks very much for the call. It is time now for Smart Assets, and as you know, or probably know, I am retiring from Wisconsin Public Radio at the end of the month, less than 3 weeks, and Kevin is making sure that I and others in my position are ready to go. What are we going to talk about this week, Kevin?
Today, Joy, we are going to talk about the exciting topic of long-term care insurance. This is actually something that when you're 25 years old and the whole world's your oyster and you have the oyster by the tail, or whatever the analogy is, it's not something you really want to think about. But the older you get, the more likely it becomes a concern of yours, especially if you have parents who go through the need to go to a nursing home or assisted living. You see how much it costs. You start worrying about it for yourself and what it will do to your finances. The likelihood and the length of a stay in the nursing home and the cost of it, the numbers are all over the board on it. But you can say, let's say you have a 70% chance of needing some type of care, assisted living or going to the nursing home. And let's say the length is, let's say it's a year. And let's say it costs $7,000 a month. Well, if you multiply all that out, that's $84,000 times 70%. That means that you probably need to set aside $60,000 to $80,000 for this future purpose. And keep in mind that some of the payment for this, if you're alive, you are going to qualify to still receive your Social Security and any pension checks you have coming. So that can help offset that $7,000 or $8,000 a month cost.
Still, though, that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money, and that's why people are so interested in long-term care insurance. It usually costs about $200 to $400 per month per person. And as a rule of thumb, it kind of pays out a similar amount per day, meaning if you're paying $200 a month for a long-term care insurance policy, you're probably going to get $200 a day in coverage, or $6,000 per month if you have coverage that lasts for 3 years and has a three-month elimination period, meaning you have to go into the facility for 90 days before the insurance will kick in and start paying for the coverage.
So do you recommend that people purchase long-term care insurance?
They should consider it, especially if they're their assets are between $200,000 and $2 million. If they have less money than that, they probably can't afford the premiums. If they have any more than that, they should self-insure, meaning just paying for out of pocket. Because, again, it even if it's $50,000 or $100,000 or $200,000, that's 5 to 10% of a $2 million net worth. If you have $2 million, you can definitely afford to pay for it out of pocket. But even for the people who do look into long-term care insurance, there are several problems that are going to give you pause. One is you may not qualify for it, especially if you have any health issues or there's a likelihood they're going to pay out in the near term. Even if you do qualify, it can be very expensive. Again, you're looking at probably $200 to $400 per month. The older you are, the more expensive it is. And you may never need this. You know, most of us would prefer to die at 90 in our own bed in our home. And if that's indeed the way things pan out, the long-term care insurance company will probably put a statue of you up in the lobby because they'll say she paid in all these premiums for 30 years and she never asked a penny of it in return. We got to keep all the money for it. And that company, despite their best intentions and their wishes, they may not be able to pay for it. Several long-term care insurance companies priced their premiums too low way back when. They expected that more people would drop the coverage. They didn't expect people to live as long as they have, and they expected to make more money on the invested premiums. They haven't, and so they've had to go back to the original policyholders and say, I'm really sorry, we have to raise up your premiums now. And that's created a problem for those people who do have the policy.
Yeah, so what should those people do?
Well, if you have one, I'd like you to keep it. If they do come to you and say, we are raising your premiums up, you may want to look at just reducing the coverage somewhat. Usually, to keep the premium the same, you don't have to reduce the coverage that much. You might have to drop an inflator off of it, meaning it's just a flat dollar amount rather than being inflated up 3 to 5% per year as to what they will cover. And if you keep the premium the same, it will be more palatable to your budget. If you are thinking about getting a new one, again, remember that your Social Security, your pension, your other assets, you can cover it. And if you're a single person and you are a homeowner, or you are the single survivor, the sole survivor in a couple, if you have a paid-for home, by definition, you probably don't need that home anymore. And you can either sell it and use the proceeds to pay for a nursing home or long-term care or assisted living. Or you can take out a reverse mortgage or a home equity line of credit, hopefully, to pay for a short-term stay if you want to try to get back into the house. Another way to look at this is go out, take a look for the long-term care insurance, see what it costs, and then take that dollar amount. Instead of sending it to the insurance company, put it in a separate bank account every single year. If you need long-term care insurance the next day, your current assets and your Social Security will probably cover what you need. But if you need it later, you should have built up that account to a level where it can pay that $50,000 to $100,000 that you might need to pay for your nursing home care.
All right. Kevin, I need to do more research on this. Where do I go?
Well, you're going to have a lot of free time for this kind of fun research in a few weeks. One of the best sites out there is longtermcarelink.net, longtermcarelink.net. And we'll have a link to that up at our website, onyourmoney.com. And you can also tune in on Saturday at noon on September 23rd and Tuesday, September 26th at 8 a.m., where we will be having our Wisconsin Public Radio membership drive special On Your Money show. And to honor Jory Cardine's career and retirement, you can get a copy of our mini money booklet, Get Ready to Retire, when you pledge any dollar amount during those On Your Money broadcasts.
Good. Can't wait. You know, a listener named David wrote to us, and he has taught finance at Winona State University for 30 years. He's a regular listener of the show. He says, Kevin, that you do a great job bringing this stuff down to earth. And he added that I would be missed. That's very kind of you, David. And David requested that we play this song. So let's play this as we go into break, as I remind you that you are listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and it's time for our Shop Around segment. And the news has been dominated by all kinds of local and global threats. We have some items that you should consider buying to prepare yourself and your family for a disaster. What do you have in mind, Kevin?
Well, these are big disasters like floods and fires and storms, or little smaller, more personal emergencies, like you might have a fire in your own home. You might have a power outage that only affects you and your neighbors. And having some things set aside not only makes a bad situation hopefully a little better, but preparing for it can help alleviate the stress over the possibility. If you start laying awake at night, staring at the ceiling, wondering about this awful thing you were dumb enough to read about on your phone right before you went to bed, you can sleep a little better knowing, well, I've already addressed that. We have these things. We've done these steps. So we've taken these measures. We'll be a little bit ahead of everybody else who's still struggling with the problem.
Yeah, I have to admit, seeing all the horrible hurricane damage and coverage, and we've been talking about we need to be better prepared. Where should we start?
Well, for the flood and the damage, I'm wearing one of those small kid floaty inner tubes around my waist at all times. Wherever I go.
Yeah, I'm going to put those things on my arms.
Yeah, on your floaties. You never know when the flash flood's going to hit, and you'll be so much smarter floating above everyone else at Walmart or whatever, floating through the aisles. Yeah, start with three different areas: sustenance, health, and power and communication. For sustenance, make sure you have water. You need about a gallon per day per person, and one of the best ways to store water is in those big 5-gallon bottles. Usually the water will last about 6 months, and water stays good indefinitely if it's not contaminated. It might taste a little weird after the 6 months, but you can just rotate those out. Set a reminder on your phone that every 6 months to dump the one out or dump it in your garden and then refill it with some fresh water in it. You also might want to keep some purification tools or tablets around so that if you are getting water from a questionable source, it'll hopefully still be healthy for it. Probably want to keep a fire starter around, some matches or something like a charcoal grill lighter, one of those little electric handheld lighters to help it if you need fire at all. A few boxes of your favorite energy or power bars for food. If you have a baby, you might want to keep some baby formula around. And don't forget about your pet. You probably want to have some water for the pet, plus an extra bag of dog or cat food around as well.
And don't forget about our medical needs, right? What about the health category?
Yeah, exactly. Start with the first aid kit, but also if you're on any crucial medications, keep an extra supply of those around that you can scoop and go and take with you wherever you go. If you have prescription eyeglasses, keep a spare pair handy for it. Personal hygiene as well. Again, for the baby, if you probably need a big bag of diapers, you might want to consider some face masks. They're very inexpensive, but that can help if there's some kind of, you know, some smoke or something like that, and help protect your lungs for it. And then those little Mylar blankets that they always pass out in emergencies and other emergencies like the end of marathons and whatever, those can fold up to almost the size of a matchbook, and that can help keep you warm if you need it.
What about power, electronics, that sort of thing?
Right. I'd like to see you have a solar or a crank phone charger, something that you can charge your phones with so you can get information. Hopefully, if you have cell service, you can at least get some information, communicate with people. Same thing for a weather radio, something that you can hear about if there's any impending weather or any emergency alerts that you need to know about. Flashlights, a crank one, solar one is good, and also tons of extra batteries, and don't get just the AAAs or AAs. Get all of them because you never know which ones you might need. And then this is something I've had for a long time, and it's actually come in handy several times, is to have an inverter for your vehicle. That's something that you can plug into the what used to be known as a cigarette lighter, but now that hardly anybody ever smokes anymore, that's, I don't know what they're going to call it, but it's the power source in your vehicle, and you can plug it in there, and then you can plug something with an electrical cord in it, whether it's a charger or what have you, right into the vehicle. And as long as it's a small enough item, it won't damage the battery, and if you turn the vehicle on, it can help charge that in an emergency.
Well, it's a lot of stuff to buy and store for something. You know, certainly we're not going to get a hurricane here, but maybe a tornado. Do we really need all of that?
Well, much of that stuff you'll eventually use. The key is always, of course, not running out of it. And, of course, I can guarantee a few things other than that you will run out of it in an emergency if you don't prepare for it. So have just an extra stock on hand. And when you're down to your last, diaper bag or whatever, package of diapers, go get a second one rather than waiting until the diaper is all gone. And if you have like a larger trunk at home, or maybe a plastic bin or something that's got handles or wheels, a suitcase with wheels on it, that's a good place to keep any of this extra stuff so you can grab it and go in a hurry if you need to. And you might also want to get a backpack, put that in your vehicle as well, that just has a smaller version of all of the things that we've talked about today.
Yeah. Good idea. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, there's still time for you. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. 1-800-642-1234 or onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's go to Karen and Nina. Hi, Karen.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is, about 6 months ago, I rolled my 401k into a self-directed IRA with Vanguard. I haven't invested it, though I have a plan for what exactly I want to do, but I haven't really invested it yet because the market's been so high, and I'm just concerned about, you know, buying really high, and then if something happens, I'll just lose money just because I bought so high. So I've been kind of paralyzed trying to decide, you know, exactly what's the best way to handle this.
Yeah, Karen, do you need the potential growth that the stock market or stock market mutual funds are purported to give to be financially secure?
Not yet. My husband hasn't retired, so I have about 18 months before, you know, he retires, and then, yes, then we will have to live on our money.
Well, and that actually brings up an interesting point, because whenever you're investing, you have to ask yourself two questions. Do we need growth, and are we willing to handle loss to try to get that growth? And that's the eternal question. But some people, if they do a proper analysis of the situation, they'll find out that either they don't need the growth or they can't handle the loss. And you sound like you're in the latter category. I will say this. The stock market, again, as measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is high. It's very high. But people have been saying for decades that it's high. And they said it was as high at 2,000 25 years ago or whatever that was. And now it's at 22,000. So metrics that are used to gauge the value are at a very, what I would say, precarious point right now. That doesn't mean that the stock market is going to go down, that it's going to go down tomorrow, that it's going to stay down if it does go down. But it just means in the past, when conditions like this have arisen, it's typically marked the high point for prices. And so you're right to be concerned about it, but you have to ask yourselves, are we willing to forego some of the return by putting the money, let's say, in CDs and getting 1% to 2% on it so that we don't incur any loss? And there's really no time where you can say, well, I'll put my money in the stock market today because I'm less likely to have a loss or I'm unlikely to have a loss. That's not possible. If there is more reward, there's going to be more risk. You either have to cut back your spending to live on what you have on the principal for it, or you have to stomach the risk and say, we're just going to go back in and not with everything, of course, but with a portion of this. And we're going to accept the fact that we may have a 20 or 30 or 40% loss in a really bad year. But we know that we need to accept that possible risk if we need also to get a higher rate of return over the very long term, the 20 or 30 years you're likely to be using this money.
So one thing we had considered with doing this is maybe just gradually putting the money, you know, into the market. Actually, what I was going to do is various index funds to just kind of have a nice balance. But we considered maybe just doing maybe a third of it at a time and see if that kind of helps buffer our...
It can. I mean, you know, whatever you put in it, whether it's a dollar or $1 million, you have to, before you invest that dollar or that $1 million, you have to say, how will I feel if this dollar turns into 50 cents 12 months from now, or if this $1 million turns into $500,000? And, you know, if you have $1 million, let's say, and it drops 30% down to $700,000, what you'd hope you'd say is, hey, we still have $700,000. That's not what people say. They end up saying,
We lost $300,000. The old adage that interest becomes principal in 6 months. After you've had it for 6 months, it doesn't feel like it's money that you made recently. It feels like money that you've earned, that it's yours, and if it goes down, you've lost it. And it's hard enough to do that anyway. It's especially difficult to do when you're on the cusp of retirement and you're losing paychecks and you now need to start losing the money off. So you can start doing dollar cost average if you want. But again, whether the decision is with a dollar or $1 million, whether you make it through one-time investment or every single month, you have to be able to say yes to the question, are we okay if this drops 30 or 40 or 50% in a given time frame?
Good luck to you, Karen. Thank you very much for the call. Kevin, we're getting lots of questions about the Equifax hack from our earlier segment. Ann in Fall Creek asks whether freezing your credit report in the wake of a security breach can be problematic for parents and students when filling out a FAFSA, the financial aid thing.
Right. You should definitely fill out the FAFSA. I don't think that a frozen credit report will hurt if and when you're trying to get the FAFSA. It will hurt when the lender is going to lend you money that you may have qualified for in student or parent loans based in part on what you completed in the FAFSA. And they'll let you know if it's a problem. They'll say, we're trying to lend you this money. We can't do it because you've frozen your credit reports. We use Experian or TransUnion or whatever. Please open that up for us for the next 48 hours so that we can go into it and verify your information. Then you can close it back up again, and that's pretty normal procedure. Again, it's a hassle, but it's part of the process.
Yeah, and this is somewhat similar, but a listener says, in light of the recent Equifax hack, I am concerned for my child. I have taken steps for myself, but I have not done anything with respect to her credit. We have many years before she is of legal age, and I'm wondering if it is a good idea to freeze her credit account with the big three until we're ready to apply for college. What do you think?
So, absolutely. Yeah, I do think that's a good idea. And more importantly, if your mother or father is older, 80 or 90 years old and isn't computer savvy, you should, on their behalf, go and check and see if their information's been compromised. And it's a very good idea to freeze their credit reports as well, if they'll let you, and help them do it, because they're more likely to not notice things in their finances that are going to be some fraudulent transactions. They're more likely to be taken advantage of. And so this is one way you can help protect them. And it can actually start a conversation about their finances. If you've been concerned about maybe they're slipping a little bit and they maybe are a little too proud to ask for your help or assistance, you can say, hey, Mom, did you hear about this? Did you do anything? Are you concerned about it? If so, would it be okay if I just, dialed up your information on the Equifax site and then maybe went about freezing your credit reports for you? And, oh, by the way, you have to monitor your checking accounts or your debit accounts. Are you okay with that? And if not, that can be a good segue into a conversation about if and when it's time to let the younger adult child kind of help the older parent out.
Pat emails, for a married couple, do we each have to do a separate credit freeze?
Yes, you do. If it you have to do a credit freeze for every single Social Security number involved in the relationship, whether it's a joint account or not, you still have to, because if they have one credit card or one Social Security number, rather, they can open a credit card for that person, whether it's it's otherwise a jointly held account.
Yeah, asking for a friend, Kevin, if you have no, I'm not going to take out a loan. I don't think I need my credit checked for any reason whatsoever. Maybe I should just freeze this stuff permanently.
Yeah, I wish you wouldn't, because I took the liberty out of concern for you and Rob. I monitor your credit situation so far. Things are good, but it's kind of my little superhero in me coming out protecting the people I care about. No, you should definitely freeze it, even if you are thinking about borrowing money. Here's what happens. If and when your information is compromised, somebody else steals your Social Security number, is able to open up a credit card by having the statement sent to a P.O. box or some other address, and then charges up a bunch of charges on the credit card. The good news is when you finally find out about those, it's fairly easy to prove that that was not you who made those charges. And the bank says, okay, fine, never mind. You don't owe us anything. The problem is in the time between the charges happen and the time when you discover it, those unpaid debts can be sold to bill collectors. And they can be sold again and again and again. And you can get a call 5 years after this happened that says, hey, we're so-and-so bill collector agency. you had a MasterCard account, you charged up $15,000, you didn't pay it back, you owe us the money, pay it right now, we're going to take you to small claims court. And you say, well, no, that wasn't me. And they say, yeah, no kidding, that's what everybody says when we call them. And so you're trying to kind of prove a negative to people who really aren't equipped to do it, nor are they interested in doing it. And that's really where the hassle of this is all going to come to a head, is when the information is compromised, you didn't owe any money for it, but for some reason you get dinged by it. So that's why you have to monitor your credit report. And then definitely, like you said, Joy, freeze your credit report as well.
The website of the week, Kevin?
Redcross.org. I'm sure you've heard of it, but Redcross.org not only tells how you may be able to help victims of the recent disasters, but also gives you several steps on preparing yourself for emergencies. And they even have links now to suggested items that you should think about buying to prepare yourself for a disaster. Redcross.org will have a link to that website and all of the websites we've mentioned today at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. On Your Money is heard live Tuesday mornings at 8 and rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing the program. I'm Joy Kerr-Dean. This is the Ideas Network.